So the topic tonight is, are we having fun yet? So it seems like a good topic. But I guess before we know whether we're having fun, I guess we've got to figure out what fun is. So, I mean, the reason for the topic is almost everybody I talk to is interested in having fun. So they're always talking about, let's go have fun, or are you having fun, or what's having fun? So it seems like a good topic. Maybe we can go around first. I'll just say a couple words to the people that are new. This is our fourth topic. The first topic was freedom, what the nature of freedom is, and in that time, and we spent quite a bit of time there on having a sense of confidence in a kind of what we would call in the West, we call it, but it's kind of the opposite of what in the West we call human nature, that your fundamental nature, having a confidence in that, and the freedom is not being so controlled by your habituation, and learning to have a certain amount of expansiveness of consciousness and freedom of consciousness that doesn't have to go somewhere habitually. So we spent quite a bit of time on that the first time. Then we talked about happiness the second time, and the third time we talked about obsessions. The question was, how do we get obsessed and get all caught up in something? So those were the three topics, and now we're going to figure out, are we having fun yet? Let's look at fun. It's one of those words that we use all the time, but do we know what we mean when we're saying, are we having fun? Because it's one of those signifiers that has many different meanings to different people at different moments. What are people's... When you say, I'm going to go have fun, what does that mean to people? Fun. I'm going to have fun. I'm having fun. Is it... It's interesting because it's a very low level of expectation. You know, it's not like, let's go have erotic, you know, it's not like, let's go be erotic or let's do something really intense or fun is a pretty low level of expectation. I mean, that's like playing in the sandbox is fun. You know, it's a fairly low bar. So it's a kind of interesting, when you look at the word from, you know, having a pleasant experience, is it one of the first things I think we want to think about with it is having fun the absence of something like anxiety, or is it the discharge or something of something, is it something positive, is it something about a pleasant feeling based on something achieved, or is it based on the absence of anxiety? How much of it is the absence of something, and how much is it the achievement of something or something? If you could put it kind of a positive versus the absence of anxiety. So as you experience, as the people here experience fun, or they hang out with other people who are having fun, there's, you know, Vegas fun. There's many different kinds of fun. So what would people, what's their first thoughts on their experience of fun? What's the nature of it? Yeah.
So I would say you can't categorize it as entirely absent things, because you could go on a ride or some activity that is sort of risky, and there's that edge of risk, the danger of possibly getting road rash or something like that. That's a little bit of fear and anxiety, but that also makes it fun when you've accomplished it.
So overcoming fear and anxiety, is that everybody...
So it's not, my point is that it's not the absence of...
No. We're not for sure what we're going to go around and say. So it's not just the absence. It's everybody would have a moment of fun like that. We'll go around and see.
Not everyone would.
Not everyone? Not everybody likes the edge fun?
No.
You're not an edge fun person?
Not that kind. Are you going to fall and hurt yourself? I hate that.
See, it's different.
So that's not fun. So being right at the edge is not as much fun for you.
Not that edge.
Okay.
Different edge, I'll take.
So what's another?
I think you need to know what you are doing. That's the key. So it doesn't matter what kind of fun you want to define. It could be take some risk. It could be just relax at home. But you need to know very clear what you are doing. If you have no idea what you're doing, most likely you probably won't have much fun.
But some people.
Well, everybody, we're gonna put different things out there, and we'll see. We have very different ideas of fun. Yeah.
I think a fun is a stimulation. So in terms of the paradigm that you played out, in like the absence and the opposite of the absence, I tend to think that if there is an absence, that I don't tend to have as much fun because. I think of fun as like other people or an activity that I'm doing. So
engaging?
Right, engaging it with the outer world. So if I'm just kind of sitting at home, there's that habituation you talk about where you're not really stimulating your senses with new and novel ongoings, and that's not as fun.
So stimulation of the senses, making contact, for you, those are elements of fun. What was the last one?
Connections with other people.
Okay, so connections and stimulation of the senses. Mm-hmm. Everybody would knows when that, and that can be fun and not fun.
Yeah, that's right.
What's the nature of it when those things are fun versus when the very same things are not fun?
I suppose that's factually dependent, right? Like on the person's likes and dislikes. So, they had this argument very briefly about whether they like risk or not. And whether you like risk or not can determine whether you find that fun or not, and that's as variable as there are people, I think.
Okay, what are some other?
I was gonna say the first thing I thought of was like authentic enjoyment, something that feels natural, organic, that you genuinely have pleasure doing. So, whatever feels most appropriate for someone.
So it's appropriate.
Like an authentic awareness of what you enjoy doing.
Okay, authentic awareness of what you enjoy doing. What's some other, what are other people's?
Absence of boredom.
Absence of boredom is fun? Okay.
It can be fun too.
Quiet, but still not bored.
Mm-hmm. Well, boredom is one of those barriers, one of those emotional barriers that you either get through or you don't get through. Like there's certain kind of, everybody knows what I mean. I would say they're kind of gateways. Like you're sitting still, and then you have to sort of get through the gateway of what we're calling boredom to get to the other side of it, which is not. It's sort of a gateway, if you want to call it emotion. There's a certain kind of gateway emotions like that. Does everybody know what I'm saying? They arise in the absence of, and then if you get through the absence of, something's on the other side of it that's more still or something. But if you don't, then that boredom drives you back out into action in sort of a habituation. So boredom's an interesting question, because I'd say probably a lot of people are driven towards what they're calling fun in a sort of habituation away from something like boredom. I mean, that could be a driving force in looking for fun. When you look for fun, can you find it? Or is it something that happens spontaneously? Does it happen more spontaneously, or?
I think it has a lot to do with the expectations you have of doing something. So if you go in with the expectation something's going to be great and it's not, then it's not fun. But if you go in kind of just like, this is what I'm doing, then it's fun.
So fun has something to do with expectations, which is a really interesting sort of, I would say, contemporary, one of the really interesting contemporary values is a lack of expectations, because it's a really good safety. Lack of expectations is a very safer place to be, right, than really high expectations. Is everybody? And in fact, in the contemporary world, you have to be very careful, because having very many expectations is almost territorializing the other person's space, right? Like, get out of my face with all these expectations. I'm just hanging out, right? So it's interesting because, expectations, I think the thing of expectations is a really interesting question in terms of fun. If you have high expectations, then if you don't achieve those, then it's a, you don't feel it's as much fun. If you had lower expectations, you, which is a very interesting kind of, because two of the most important values of contemporary society is a question of lower expectations and fun. Those are like sort of the new conscience. You know, it's like guilt. You feel guilt if you're not having enough fun, right? It's almost like it's become in the place of what conscience was before about quote-unquote guilt. The new conscience is more about not having enough fun. I should be having more fun. You almost feel guilty if you're not having more fun, right? It's almost like a superego. It's almost like the new superego. It used to be the old superego in the old days was guilt about activity. Now the new superego is almost like an introjection of not having enough fun. I should be having fun.
Is there like a hedonistic imperative?
It's a kind of hedonistic imperative. Are we living in a kind of, in an absence of other values, then, I mean, it's a totally logical, though. I want to point out that in the modern and the contemporary, I don't want to say modern, in a contemporary context, hedonism is a logical, is a logical bottom line of value. Is everybody fine? Because if you're taking, for instance, a scientific technological view, then the personal conscious awareness that you exist within is just a projection of your mind that's basically a bunch of neurons, and you're deterministic. You're an object. You're primarily an object amongst other objects in a kind of semi-deterministic context. And the place where your conscious awareness, where the freedom of your conscious awareness, you'd spend time in the freedom of that conscious awareness, isn't necessarily valued or even like given a sense of kind of confidence or certainty in that even exists. So if you're taking a scientific technological approach, or if you're taking a historical approach, a kind of historical deterministic approach, I mean, almost every approach that you're currently given, the ultimate, when you finally look at it, the value construct of it, you're forced back to the final kind of arbitrator is your own pleasure. I mean, what is the final arbitrator in all of you? The final arbitrator of value, is the final arbitrator of value your pleasure? What would be the other arbitrator of value in a contemporary context? Can anybody give me another value that you could sell to somebody else? You might have yourself. Now remember, we're not talking that you might not have a value construct, but now I'm making you sell that value to someone else and give me a reason why they should accept your value as theirs. You see what I'm saying? I'm not saying there's probably people in here that have various values they think that they're, but if you went out into the in a relationship with other people and talked to them about it, where would you make a stand? Where would you put your marker for pushing that value forward from whatever they would put their value? So eventually you come up with a final marker is the amount of pleasure, the pleasure that comes from where would there be another common marker?
Maximizing consumer choice.
Maximizing consumer choice, though, would be a pure abstract way of pleasure, wouldn't it? I mean, that's an abstract view of pleasure, maximizing consumer choice. Because the whole of consumption is, I mean, the whole of capitalist consumption is based upon some pleasure, right?
Doing
that you would achieve.
Right?
What's that?
Doing what's ethically right.
Is a value.
Could be like the final demarker.
But what would that be? How would we determine what was ethically between the two? If we were having a discussion between them, what would be the ground of that we could agree on ethical output?
Probably depends on what culture you're coming from. But I don't know. Maybe a little bit what's passed down from your culture.
For sure, you could get it from your culture, but then you'd have to have the common culture. You see, I mean, then the ground of it would be the common culture. And if you were from the common, that's why if you want to get together with somebody and stay with them, it's better to have somebody from a common set of values, because although they're not as exciting, you don't have to work out as much, okay? You know what I'm saying? So,
Oh, I was going to say something along similar lines about, you know, lessening suffering, like fairness to others. You know, if you're talking about limiting pleasure, if you're talking about being a conscious consumer instead of maximizing your consumer choice, you buy fair trade, you buy, like, union supported, you know, like, those kinds of choices.
It's kind of a utilitarian argument.
But again, at the end of the day, you would be making those choices with a value system of what you'd be planning based on your values, right?
Mm-hmm.
How would you talk about it in a universe? How would you say that your values are universal values, or you could put on people as universal values?
I don't know if this is naive, but maybe when you were questioning him about, like, what values are universal to many cultures, I think lessening suffering is, you know, like, looking out for the wellness of others is a value. I mean, in my mindset, at least.
Yeah, I'd say that in different cultures, the category defined as everyone is different. So if you look at, say, freedom for all people, the time of Declaration of Independence, that didn't include slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Voting didn't include women. So lessening suffering for everyone depends on who's considered part of everyone.
Aren't there some awareness that these slaves are human and women are human too, even though they are scoffed? Right, even though that doesn't say so. Yeah.
Well, eventually it has developed that way.
I was going to say the right to life, like the right for life to continue to be alive, as a potential value.
And that, of course, that gets a little tricky because right to life, just even using that terminology is so. And then, you know, again, where does life start? I mean, there's a lot of things that begin to emerge. The thing is that if I think when you're talking to when you yourselves are talking to someone else who has a different view than yours, how do you set a common ground in which you could talk about it? Because if you simply give your view to them and they give your view to you, then you're just sitting there kind of. But how would you go about, on what grounds would you try to find a common ground? Where would you go?
A common
ground for a discussion between us that we could both agree upon a starting place. Where would we start on a starting place in a common ground between two people?
It seems like you're suggesting that what's pleasurable is like the common ground. Like, I'm sitting with someone from another culture and I can say, okay, like, whatever feels good to you, what feels good to me, that can be our common ground. But I would argue that what's pleasurable, or you get pleasure out of results of something else, of like following something else. Like, let's say it was ethics. Like, I feel good for doing the right thing. And that could be different. Doing the right thing for me is different than doing the right thing for someone from another culture.
For sure. I'm not actually making any. I don't have any thesis yet about this, but I'm looking at this having fun, since that's our topic, as how we would use that. You know, how would you use that, since it seems to be such a common thing. You know, everyone you talk to is talking about having fun in one form or another. So it is a kind of common theme that people seem to be using in conversations, and they must mean something by it. And so I'm wondering whether there's something about having fun that is something we can reference in each other.
Well, I think what it comes down to is when you say you're having fun, you have different people that you have different kinds of fun with. So there's sort of an implicit category of like what fun is within this collection of people you're talking to. So I don't think there is a universal definition of fun. Which
our responsibility, no matter what your cultural background, man and woman, or a senior person or little kids, when they start to seeking the fun, they have to think about the responsibility they're going to have. And maybe that's the common ground we can have, start from there. And then,
sorry,
please.
I'm going to cut you off.
I'll finish.
Okay. I thought of unconditional like regard, rather unconditional positive regard, meaning that no matter what background you're coming from, that you're finding some way. I guess it also ties with empathy too, but more of an unconditional regard for another person. That could be a common ground, because that limits away judgment and bias from the start, or that's what it's intended to do.
Interdependence. No, we cannot live alone in this society, right? We all depend on something. Our clothes made by the factory from China, Vietnam. Our food grown by the farmers. So we all depend on something so we can survive in this society. I think that's pretty common, everybody can relate to. You won't make your own clothes, you probably won't grow your own vegetable, you probably won't even draw a well and put out water from your backyard. So we all kind of rely on something so we can survive. So that's a very basic need we need to kind of pull through every day. So without that is going to be challenging.
Yeah, if Alan tell me that he's going to watch movie 24 hours without sleeping, now I'm going to discuss with him that, oh, then you think about it, because next day he might just, you know, get sick and lie on the bed and have to take care of him.
Married couple, husband and wife, so she
knows
everything about me.
Responsibility.
Yeah, I think, yeah, interrelated, interdependence, that's very common, regardless any kind of ethical background, any cultural background, any age, we all depend on something. Yeah, you cannot just survive by yourself.
I was thinking of mutual reciprocation between two people, two or more people.
Okay, when we have mutual, okay, relationship between two people, how does that work?
There has to be a common understanding between two people, maybe from past experience. I was thinking of a good friend, for example. You go out and you do something, and you sort of know that you would enjoy it, the other person would enjoy it mutually.
So, just going down that road, wouldn't most people say that some of the greatest moments of fun is hanging out with friends, you know, like hanging out with friends in a very relaxed sort of way, where you're not having to be on? I mean, I'm just throwing this out, but would everybody agree that one of the meanings of fun, I think for the contemporary moment, I think very contemporary ideas of fun is hanging out with friends and in a relaxed way where you're not putting on something, where you can just relax because you live in a sort of common values with a common respect, and so what's the nature of that? That's an interesting place where fun occurs in a sort of natural way, right? And it's very interesting in a contemporary sense, because I think that sense of fun requires a certain amount of not territorializing the other person's space, like not having a lot of desire and needs and wants in the space of the other person. So they're sort of free, the other person is kind of free to be who they are, and you're relating to them in the freedom of who they are rather than in some intentionality that you have or some kind of, is everybody fine, rather than some kind of expectation or intentionality or something you kind of want. And if there's something you sort of want in the context, it completely changes the dynamic of the tone in the space. Is everybody? And I would say that. So that's would everybody agree? That's an arena of fun. Hanging out with friends that you have common. That's relaxed, and you have to be. To do that, you have to be not too needy, you know, a little bit contained. You might bring your trips to the situation, but in a way, and you might even expect your trips to be given some regard by the other person in some sort of way, But you're not exactly expecting the person to take care of you in some fundamental sense or something, or love you in a kind of friendship and love. I mean, this is, I think it's really interesting, the relationship between friendship and love, like a romantic love versus a friendship, how relaxed a friendship is and how unrelaxed romantic love is, just as, because romantic love has all these expectations and all these emotions and stuff, and the relationship of friendship has all this sort of relaxed, almost lack of those kind of expectations. And so, you know, you don't have to perform, you know, there's not a lot of performance. Am I going down a road here? So it looks like that's an arena that has a lot of qualities to it, though. There's a lot of qualities to friendship. I think it's a really important contemporary, I wouldn't call it value, I'd call it a contemporary way of life, is that friendship is really important. Friendships are really important. And they're a kind of alternative. Friendships are sort of an alternative as a way of life to certain ways of life in the past that you felt a lot of social pressure for. And by having, you know, kind of having tribal friendships, it can take up the space that all that energy went to before in certain kind of socially pressured kind of context. Does that make sense to some people or not? I think that's a really strong contemporary tendency. Does everybody find themselves in that in some way or another? Does everybody have some rapport there?
Yeah, but I heard that when you get old, it's kind of getting harder and harder to kind of meet true friends. Just want to get a sense, I mean, does everybody here really kind of feel that way when you grow kind of older? You kind of feel kind of more difficult to kind of meet a kind of true friend.
So well, I'm only 27, so I don't know what happened.
So
I think that's because that your value changes as you grow older. So when you're younger, you're in situations where you have the same values or the same conditions with so it's in the group, so it's easier to make friends in that group. And as if you maintain that relationship as you grow older, your values more or less change together like a couple. But the older you get, when you're meeting people outside, everyone comes from a different place. And I say that because as a monk, there's a kind of kinship between monks that transcend friendship, because we all share the same values, the same way of life, the same. Even when we meet, say, Catholic monks, for example, you see, a 10,000 Buddhas hosted about 2 years ago for about a week. We had how many? Maybe 7 or 10 Catholic monks that were our guests. And although they have a different kind of belief, but there was an immediate kinship just because their way of life was very similar. Yeah.
I think this sort of goes to.
Two things to say, but there's two huge issues there, so I don't want to lose one of them while we start on the other one. One is the spiritual, one is developing in a, what we're talking here, for lack of a better word, we're going to call it spiritual, but we don't really mean that. We mean something like in a Buddhist term, it's, which we've already talked about, a kind of freedom that has a lack of habituation to it, that creates a space in yourself, a kind of empty space in yourself that really doesn't age. Conscious awareness doesn't age. The contents change, but conscious awareness doesn't age. My 96-year-old father, who I'm taking care of, has not aged in his conscious awareness. His body is deteriorating. The contents of his personality, his identity, is disintegrating. He's very frustrated at the level of his body disintegrating, his identity disintegrating, and all kinds of other elements of it. But the conscious awareness itself hasn't really changed from the time he was very young to then. I mean, the conscious awareness that you're actually using to experience, the conscious awareness that you're constantly using to be aware of things with, doesn't actually change. It's like we've talked about, it's an incredibly spacious, not really limited to the body. That's an identity it might have, but it's not really its nature. It's just, you might identify with the body, but that's not its nature. If you can gain a certain amount of this conscious awareness with not so much habituation, then several things. First of all, there really isn't any aging. And one of the things I'd say about aging is, and friendship is, that if the friendships are based on the certain conditions of a certain age, like you're hanging out with people in the mission and then you're in 26, if the friendships are based on that context alone, then as the context changes, anybody that's known that's gone through a few decades of change will realize those people they were hanging out with in that context, as they run off and then start getting, you know, maybe very few of those people you might end up still staying, hanging out with, friendships. But if the relationships were based on not just the context, but something else, which we could work, you know, work on what that something else is, some sort of connectedness, some sort of spontaneousness, some sort of trust, some sort of deep opening to, I mean, we could make a huge, big list of what those are, then they don't really change necessarily with age. And I think you would always be open to relationships in the same way if you're really open. But if you, as you age, if you get more trapped in a certain point of view, a certain ideology, a certain way you see things that you hold on to more as the years goes on out of a kind of fear, then what happens is aging is just a state of mind that's holding on to the way that you perceive things, and you hold on to it tighter and tighter and more defensively as you get older. Then you call that aging. if you don't do that, then you actually are just as young at any age. You're just equally as young. Is everybody? So, and the question of fun's interesting, because you can have an equal amount of fun. Fun isn't really age related. In fact, you can have less fun or more fun. It's not very age related, because it's a question of a state of mind. Fun is kind of is much more open to you in a certain kind of open frame of mind than it is a closed state of mind. And even lots of expectations, as was said before, already limits the space of where fun can occur. And then we can throw onto it a whole nother element. That's one element, but the other element here was a life spent more, what would you call it? I don't know, how would you define a monk's life in this regard? Well, what's the life spent doing as related to, let's say, a layperson's life? What's it focused on in a way that in its sort of fundamental ground of its experience is able to create that kind of open space and maintain it? Because the monk's frame of reference is, by not getting caught up in worldly stuff as much because of the form that's taking, it gives more freedom of a kind of mental and physical space than, as we all know, if you get caught up in something that you're sort of becomes the focus and takes up that conscious awareness. As your conscious awareness becomes focused on something, kind of gets into it, then you spend decades within the context of that. You don't have the freedom of mind that you had before you entered the context of that. The monk's context is very open and free. It's within a form, but it's very open and free, and stays open and free in a way that at-home form, we tend to get involved in stuff and have outflows more, that we don't have that kind of freedom of mind. Is everybody? So I don't know whether. So there are two. There's two issues there about. There's two big issues. Are you having fun?
All the time.
He's having fun all the time. When are we not? So we talked a little bit about fun. When are we not having fun? When do you find there's times that you, if we're kind of looking at the fun side, one of the ways to look at what fun is when we're not having fun.
Two questions.
Okay.
Okay. One is, this was from a while ago. We just noticed it. What do you mean by tribal friendships? And the second one is, what's wrong with aging?
What's wrong with it? Well,
you die.
Well, you die, but that's okay. We're going to do that. What I meant by aging, the issue of aging was what we were talking about, was getting stuck in a particular way of looking at stuff that doesn't have an opening to it, doesn't have open space to. And so as you, people tend to, when they get a particular frame of reference they get attached to, they tend to hold on to that, and then they tend to defend that and justify everything through that. And so they begin to become more and more rigid. Their mind becomes more and more rigid. They're not open because they have certain rigid. And if you notice, as years go on from that space, that's the rigidity, the aging rigidity, is being having a set of ideas that may have been actually working, but then holding on to those set of ideas in a way that you do get very defensive, and then you also get justifying and rationalizing, and pretty soon you're stuck. Your mental process is kind of stuck, and you don't have this open space to kind of attend to things in a fresh way, because as we've talked about already, it's from the cultivating point of view, the primary attitude that we have is one of, you know, like listening really carefully to what's going on. We're still and listening. The mind is like still. Your conscious awareness is very still, but very aware. And when we're relating to somebody else, we're just listening. We're not already ahead in the space of the other person, like projecting something in their space or making them up. We're kind of deeply listening. So that very aware, really listening, doesn't age. It's only when we put something into that, like a point of view, when that conscious awareness then comes up with something and puts something into that space, so we don't have that kind of open, sort of really listening, sort of really attending to, sort of really spontaneous mind. When we put something into that mind, then when as that begins to fill that up, we hold on kind of. And what I was meaning by aging is a sort of brittleness over time of a point of view that you're holding on to against everything around you. Does everybody know what? I mean, that can happen very young. this isn't something you have to get very old to have. And I would say, wouldn't you say that things are less fun? One of the elements of fun is a kind of spontaneous openness, and there's something about kind of brittle shutdownness that has, and a kind of anal shutdownness that has a lack of, like, kind of has a grit your teethness about it, life, rather than a kind of open spontaneous. I mean, it seems like an antithesis to fun, sort of. So that's what I was meaning by aging, which, if you want to do that, it's fine. I wasn't really against it. I can see how people might like to do that.
So I have what may be a parallel way of looking at it, is that I think when you're young, you have a lot more sense of possibility about your own identity and things you could do and things you want to do. So there's a lot more room for exploration. As you get older, you know, you have less time. You may have resolved some questions yourself. And so you're not as open to all those other things because you've decided, actually, I'm not interested in that. And sometimes when we make friends, we make friends as a way of exploring our own identities. And so their function is to advance your own agenda of exploring who you are and what you could be. And so as you get older, you say, okay, I'm not really interested in all these other things. I'm really focused on these things. So you may not make as many friends there. And it may seem like rigidity, and perhaps it is, but it also, in a sense, a certain clarity about who you are and what you're about. Maybe young people think that's ridiculous.
No, I don't think anything is ridiculous, but ridiculous is an overstatement, probably. But, I think identity is a really big problem. Like, I'm not sure if I'm actually interested in my identity. My identity is kind of usually boring. I think it's a real interesting question about not just about friendship, but identity is a huge question about how much you get into a certain sense of your own identity rather than staying. Do you really have less choices? It appears that you might have less choices because choices that you make might have certain kind of consequences and so forth. And for sure, in some ways, probably. But I think that's a really interesting question when you're younger then, as you look at the choices and decisions you're making, you know, what's the grounds of you making your choices? What is your criteria by which you make those kind of choices? The first week we talked about, you know, freedom as a ground of making those choices, you know, like freedom as a value you might use as making those choices, and then there would be like, as you looked at choices, if that was your value, you'd make decisions based on that. So, it's a good, you know, there's a lot of questions that are, you know, we don't have, but if we're going to this main thing of the kind of theme of, you know, freedom, and happiness, which is our first two themes, non-obsession, our third theme, and fun, what do people think is not fun?
Stress.
What?
Stress.
Stress is not fun. Do people have any stress these days?
No.
People have stress?
Occasionally.
Because it does look to me like some people mean by fun, maybe not. I mean, so far we've talked about it very positively, but I've seen a lot of people I've been hanging out with. It seemed to me what they meant by fun was the relief of stress. Now, I may be wrong, but what I noticed in hanging out, you know, clubbing or something, Vegas clubbing or something, it seems to me like it's like more like. Not so much. It's more like, you know, like a kind of super distraction of the senses in order to be relieved of anxiety and stress for a certain amount of time, with the hope that it'll last at least till 3 o'clock in the morning, and then maybe you'll hook up and maybe you won't. And then in the morning you're kind of like, you know, trying to figure out what just happened, but and then you start all over again. You know what I mean? I don't know. So that's what I meant by a relief of something. Because I think we could look at fun as much. We've been looking at it in a very positive sense, fun in a very as a kind of positive. But wouldn't you all agree that there's a lot of people these days experiencing, and even you might experience what you mean by fun as more of a relief of anxiety and stress than as a positive. Sort of intimate communication with the other in some profound sense of listening and caring. In fact, now people are laughing. Like, when did they ever do that? So, I mean, you see what I'm saying? I say, because it's very interesting. I think there is a very, right now, I think there's a very interesting question. Is a fun and open kind of intimate relationship with expectations of another person? Or is fun the relief, primarily the relief of anxiety and stress? I mean, how are most of you experiencing it? In fun is having this really great spontaneous, you know, or more as a, I mean, it's both probably. All of you probably have both. But what's the, insofar as you, around you and people around you, are they mainly experiencing it as a relief of anxiety and stress?
If I can choose, I would like to be the first one. I don't want to be the second one. Because the second fun is based on basically the condition of the anxiety. So you need to build out your stress. You need to have your anxiety. Then you can release that. So once you release that, that moment, you enjoy the fun. So that is very conditional. And for me, that's almost like disaster. Right? You have to create such a huge amount of pressure and stress, and then you get to enjoy it. So that's very ironic for me. But
that's ironic
I've
fun.
I've been through that many times when I look back. But I would prefer, I would have the first one. That kind of openness, spontaneous, that kind of joyful moment, rather than have such thing accumulate, carry on it.
So what's the ratio of those?
Very few.
Very spontaneous, joyful, intimate. I love you so much. Or like, wow, I got rid of a little stress and anxiety for a few hours, and whew, now I'm going to sleep and hope for the best tomorrow.
I feel like the first one that you described could turn into anxiety and stress, though. So I would prefer the second one.
Aha. See? I knew. See, that's interesting. No. It's very interesting because that is a very, that's what I was, you know, a little bit what I was meaning by contemporary. Even what I was saying as the first, by even getting those expectations and could lead to the second. See, because to some degree, I think there's a lack of, I would almost say, hope or faith. That there would be something sustainable in the first, that would be enough that the fun, that putting fun to that wouldn't have a risk to it. Is everybody fine? That putting that kind of expectation to something has risk. Right. And so I'd rather stay away from the risk and the fun of the second.
Right.
I mean, am I, what do people?
The second one, the fun I'm thinking of more of now is, comes almost like a routine, like I'm looking forward to doing that too, even if it's not necessarily to relieve stress, but I know that it is a valuable tool to do that. So it's almost like it's, a future expectation that I know what will provide versus the first one that could be spontaneous. At first you do it, and then I enjoyed it, but then oftentimes my experience picks up as a tool for the second.
So, so you're saying you're trying to make that into a habit then?
It becomes more of a next, I guess that's what I've, in my experience, it's been more of a way to, it's a habit that I look forward to, I guess, and it's a healthy, considered healthier habit. So for me it's like basketball or something.
Well, how do you keep maintain the spontaneity? Because it's true, once you...
In the first?
You have it spontaneous for a while.
Well,
And I'm pretty soon I'm like, damn it, why isn't this regular?
That's
this happens
a good point.
To me.
That happens
all
to me all the time.
Okay. Well, but
that's
this is
good.
but this is really, I mean, isn't it really interesting? I mean, I think it's extremely interesting. I mean, I don't know if we'll find exactly the profundity and solution of it, but does everybody not see it's interesting? That the positive way of putting it is actually a huge challenge. And the way of putting it that's a relief, everybody goes, oh, yeah, I think I'll do that more because I'll probably get there anyway, so I might as well go there first. Whoa, that's really interesting. And there is a kind of lack of something there, a lack of faith, a lack of, I would say, confidence. Let's put it that way. I think there's a lack of confidence, in a maintaining of something.
That's a slippery.
It's a slippery, of course. But you see what I'm saying? There's a lack of confidence there that's really profound.
But in the first one, aren't you kind of, like, if you're interacting with another person, you're kind of holding on to their expectations, like, you're not letting them be. Versus in the second one, it's like, I'm going to release my anxiety, or I'm going to do this for myself. Like, I have total control over myself and my clarity, versus the first one, I mean, it's fun, but, you know, the other person's still an individual that you can't control.
Ah, that you can't control.
Yeah.
Whoa. See, this is pretty interesting. So, is there a way to be with other people spontaneously that has nothing to do with control, though? That we could always be spontaneous with, and don't have a need to control them to make sure that we have the experience that we're having with them. By giving them their total freedom and they giving us our total freedom and then trusting the spontaneousness of our freedom.
If you had no need.
Well, if you had no need, but why do you have a need? See, you see where the problem lies? There is the need, not the relationship. Is everybody following me? If you had no need, you could do that. So therefore, if you took care of your own need, you know, your neediness internally, if you were able to, and which actually this is a huge element of what meditation and these skills, what is meditation? Meditation is finding a sense of confidence in your own state that has no need. Right?
Right.
It's a non-neediness state. Is everybody? You're sitting, when you're sitting, you're finding that fundamental ground of stillness, but that stillness isn't like stillness in a nihilism. It's a stillness of existence, and it's one of the elements of that stillness of existence is a non-neediness, because neediness is based upon a lack of being appreciated or something that you're making up. It's all you're making it up. It's just a projection. I am not appreciated enough and never have been. It's so sad. And, you know, you're expecting to get appreciated by someone in a way that will never happen anyway, in the way that you're projecting to need it. And so you set up these internal things about yourself that then you project, and then they're both an internal falsity, and then you project the internal falsity on other people. If you had the non-neediness as a state, a confident state of still aware non-neediness, confident state of your deep, I'm completely okay, completely contented, completely solid with myself, and I'm going to go share this totally contented, totally together, totally still existence, and then relationship is sharing that. I'm not getting, there's nothing to get. Right? There's nothing actually you can get in a relationship. There's only a projection that you can make that you'll always have a difficulty with, because you're projecting. You're not actually relating to the other person. You're projecting on them who you think they want to be, you want them to be, and then they are either like that or not, and then it either lasts as long as the projection works out or not.
And they're doing the same to you.
And they're doing the same to you, so it's just like a big old factory of projections. So, but it's grounded in something that if you could cultivate this, the stillness, the concentrated stillness of meditation, it's not that you're doing that to empty into nihilism. You're doing that so you could actually first ever relate to anybody. You can't relate to anybody when you're in your own habitual trip of your own lacking, needing, blah, blah, blah. Because then you're just projecting on everybody else that they're going to somehow satisfy that, which they're never going to do. And they're just projecting their same stuff on you. So it's this endless. And then as soon as you start putting expectations into the space, there's endless disappointment. There's endless disappointments going all around to everybody. Then we get to have all disappointments with each other, go around and around in circles and disappointments. Is everybody? But it's all based on a false beginning place. Is everybody? if you could really cultivate so that your mind was really still, you were really, really aware, really concentrated, but really still, and really confident in your kind of innermost ability to be in control, your innermost ability to be not so needy, then wouldn't that you then took into relationship be something quite different? Just a thought. And related to fun is interesting because then the relationship to other people actually could always be fun. But in a different way of fun, because it wouldn't be fun by relieving anxiety, which isn't even there. You wouldn't be doing stuff to relieve anxiety or stress. You'd be doing stuff because you're choosing to hang out in the spontaneous enjoyment of their existence. Not to romanticize, but... And since there's nothing you need from the other person, their existence is enough. Just their existence is enough, because there's nothing you need. So their existence is enough, so hanging out with anybody is okay, it's fun. And there's nothing that they can do or not do that somehow has to do with the conditions of it. Is there?
So you're saying if your needs are met internally, like within yourself, then everyone's existence is positive?
If your needs are met within itself, then you could actually start relating to other people.
Instead of falsely.
You can't relate to other people out of your needs. Because you're just projecting your needs on them. And good luck. Good luck on that. I wish you really good luck on that. The history of that has not been great, you know. Now maybe we'll find a new future, but as far as I know so far, we've been doing that for 10, 20, 30, I don't know how many millions of years, and it has not worked out that well. So I would suggest try a different, you know, thing. If you take care of your own needs by getting into the really confident ground of who you really are, and from that ground relate to other people, then the relationships are of a totally different nature. They're not about neediness. They're not about expectations of need. They're about sharing existence. And yeah, we want to share existence together because we all have the same, you know, conscious. I'm looking at you, and you probably have the same conscious awareness I do that you're using and experiencing stuff with. The habituation that's probably going on in your mind is quite different than mine. But the actual conscious awareness that you're using as the ground of your experience and mine are probably very similar, although the contents might be quite different. And so if we're experiencing each other at that level of our conscious awareness, our shared conscious awareness, and not necessarily the habitual contents of it, then we could begin to move towards an equality, for instance. An equality of people, we'd for the first time be relating to each other, actually truly seeing each person in a sort of non-discriminative equal way, not based on characteristics that we're projecting on them from our own fears, desires, identities, blah blah blah, but on their existence. And we could begin to move towards relating to a few people. We could begin to move towards in Buddhism we call the bodhisattva, which is a recognition that all consciousness, including animal consciousness, is of the same nature, and that we have a responsibility to relate to all consciousnesses in an equal, intense, caring way. But in order to care for every conscious awareness in that kind of way, we have to get out of our own our neediness is also called our karma. The word karma is referring to the structure of neediness that you have. It's not some abstract causality. There's no abstract causality. Karma is the construct of your neediness you bring into this present moment. So you do not have the freedom of consciousness in this present moment that's actually, you actually potentially and actually have. The actual freedom of this moment is lost in the karma of the neediness that you have that you bring into it. So, fun. So actually, fun is funny because it's a fairly low level of enjoyment. It's a very low bar. Why not be in ecstasy every moment? Or why don't you go for something a little bit, why don't you go for something a little higher than fun? Like, you know, why not be like a glow in consciousness every moment, containing the entire universe, all the universes of all time and space, without any limitation whatsoever in the... Why not get into your conscious awareness at the level that is not completely contained by your attachment to the body? So your conscious awareness is actually taking up all time and space and isn't limited by anything. Why don't you try that one, see how that works, or something like that. More interesting.
There's so many distractions around us.
Ah. But why does it distract you? Why are the distractions interesting? There's plenty of distractions, but why are they interesting? The question isn't that there's a lot of distractions. The question for each of us is, why is that distracting to me? Because to blame all the distractions, we'll never get anywhere. Are there distractions? There are 100 trillion million. But that isn't the problem. The problem is why I am being distracted by that. What is it about that that's distracting me? What's interesting about that that's distracting to my conscious awareness? What do I have habitually that triggers? See, because the only place that you'll ever get anywhere is by taking full responsibility for everything that's happening in your consciousness and understanding the habituation of why that's happening and not put it on anything outside of your own consciousness. You cannot, if you want freedom, we talked about this the first night, If you want freedom of consciousness, you have to take absolutely 100% responsibility for every state. Because if you give the responsibility for your state of mind to anything outside of yourself, you, by definition, don't have freedom. Does everybody understand? You've given it to a determinate factor outside of yourself. I realize these days everybody's looking for an excuse, but it isn't going to do you any good. Because looking for excuses is just giving away the place where you have power to an explanation outside of your own process. And every time you put the reason outside of your own process, then you've lost the power and the freedom that you actually have. Because you've given it to something outside. Is everybody? Even though I know that everyone's been trained to do that, it's really stupid. Because there's no other place you could possibly have freedom and power than in the place that you yourself are being distracted by that. Is that making sense to you? So we could look at fun as the moment that a habit is less powerful. So we could look at, you see, we could take the flip side, we could say, on one side, fun is having a big enough distraction to lose ourselves from the anxiety and stress that we're having through another distraction, which is the other kind of fun. The second kind of fun we're talking about is basically a distraction that distracts us from our stress. When I'm clubbing, it seems like that's what's happening, right? We're having... And there's enough distraction that whatever stress I have is like overwhelmed by the distraction for like a few hours or something like that. And then everybody's taking off. Okay, so that seems like it's a distraction, but that's a distraction of the... Okay, but if we're looking at it from the other, you can see if You could also see fun as the opposite place where the habituation wasn't as great, so I gained a split second of freedom from the habituation, and then the experience of that's almost the opposite. It's like a fun. The fun of less distraction is an actual freedom, whereas the fun of a distraction from my anxiety is not a freedom. If you're looking at it from the point of view of freedom, you have to be really careful, because what a lot of people are calling fun is the habituation of a new distraction over their old distractions. It's not really a freedom. That I would be concerned about the contemporary, a lot of contemporary activity, mainly because I'm not sure if it's conducive to a greater amount of freedom, but actually just creating other habituations that are taking the place of anxieties and stresses that just become other levels of habituations with no real space of freedom there at all. Is everybody following?
Yeah, I don't want to distract you.
No, go ahead.
Say about that. I think just this is my first time at this temple, and I was curious what you think Buddha has to say about fun. Is it those things that you're saying?
Well, what I just said was Buddha's idea of fun. What I
like the clubbing.
The less habitual. What the Buddha would say is exactly what I just said. The Buddha would say it's a little bit different way. You don't read the sutra. I'm restating the sutra in a slightly different contemporary thing. The Buddha would say that fun is the less habitual. In other words, the question for the Buddha is how to gain the greatest amount of freedom. So the question is, where do you lose freedom is in the habitual. That's called karma, right? In Buddhist terms. So karma is also called the habitual, okay? So anytime you can gain freedom from the habitual is an opening of this spontaneous, awareness that's a kind of fun that's based upon freedom, this kind of freedom that you're gaining from habituation. Every time you act on, like for instance, you're taking an action that's avoiding stress, but it's another level of high levels of sense input. It's usually creating another habituation on top of the one you had, and that isn't actually freedom. That's just actually it's losing stress recovery, but in the process of it, you're creating another habituation. So you have to be very, very careful when you're trying to avoid stress, because it's not a question of avoiding stress, it's a question of getting at the bottom of how the stress is initially occurring. And the stress is initially occurring always through habituation of mind, lack of freedom of mind. If your mind was really free, if it was really free, there wouldn't be any stress. Where would the stress be that you'd need to avoid? If your mind was really free, and you weren't so limited by your habituation, then you wouldn't have the stress that needed to be avoided by over-sensitive. So you got to go back and start from the freedom at the ground level, because any time you try to do it through further habituation, it's just create another habituation on that. Then you have to work your way through that. So even if you're successful with getting less stress from an activity, if it in itself is more habituating in itself, now you're going to have to get rid of that to get back to the free mind, because now you're going to have to get rid of whatever you've added on top of that to get rid of that. So that's the principle in general. Does that make sense? Or? Yeah?
Can you go back a little bit? What is need?
Yeah. Need is everything you think you need. Like through your lifetime, from the time you were born and probably before, but we'll just start with when you're born. Your mother didn't love you enough, probably. Your daddy didn't love you enough, probably. When you popped out of the womb, it was probably really a big pain because it's light. And before you were just taking care of in this night womb, so you popped out. So right away from the very beginning, it's like, okay. And then from that moment on, things got worse. Okay. And from this very early on, there's just from a little baby on, you had all these little experiences where you didn't always get what you want. And Mick Jagger You know, the stones at least understood that very well. Can't always get what you want, but if you try real hard, you can get what you need. Okay, so without getting philosophical, we don't want to get into the philosophers like the Rolling Stones. But so the point is that from the very early age, we set up all these deep-seated wants, needs, and desires, lackings. We have all this sense of lacking. We have all this sense of wanting. And depending on how you then relate to that from childhood into adolescence, then you, as you get into adolescence, you start telling stories. Like at 17, 18, you have a story about life of how you're going to get your needs met. You know, around 16, 17, you get this story, this narrative story. Now, you haven't tried it out very much, or you're going to go try it out. Then 21, 22, you try it out, and it works or it doesn't work. You kind of make a few adjustments to it. And so your neediness is based on really deep-seated lackings and wantings that have now taken the form of projections on objects, projections on people, projections on emotions. You have a whole set of emotions now related to this that are habitual. Because remember, all emotions are past experiences. And when you bring an emotion to the present moment, you're taking the present experience, which is always neutral. The moment, this moment right now we're having is absolutely new and absolutely neutral. But you're not experiencing this present moment as absolutely new and neutral, because what you do is you apply your past experience to it. And when you apply your past experience, you put an idea or an emotion in association with it. And that putting an emotion to this present moment is called your karma. You take your past and apply it to your present. And when you take your past emotion and your thought and apply it to the present, you're never living in the present moment. You're never living spontaneous in the present. You're always living in the past in the present moment. Okay, you're always living in the past and the present. All emotion and thought is the past and the present moment. So rather than when the Buddha says everything is empty, the Buddha is meaning that in the present moment, there's no habit that you're not bringing to it. It's open. It's free. The present moment is always free. It's always open. But you bring the past to it by habit, and so you destroy every spontaneous present moment with the past by habit, okay? So, and all of you, most everyone in here has built in that, those patterns, a set of like needs and lack from lackings they feel back in their childhood and so forth, that now they have all kinds of emotions about, and then they project onto objects. Now, capitalism works perfectly, because if you take a bunch of people with a lot of lacks and then you throw capitalism on top of it, it's a perfect system. Because you have a million possible things that the object of desire will satisfy. So it puts you in an endless array of things that you're projecting as objects of desire to satisfy your needs that you have that will solve the lackings. And if you notice, they've never worked. If they worked, that would be in the capitalism. Right, capitalism depends on the object of desire don't work. They can't work. They have to always just tickle your fancy with the thought that something might have, you know, been satisfied, but then there's always something new, you know, blah, 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 blah. So when you put our psychological state of lacking together with capitalism, then you've got our current state, constantly looking for objects of desire to satisfy our needs and lackings. And so we're in a constant state of need that never gets satisfied. And if we're looking outside, it can never get satisfied, because the outside we're creating to satisfy it will never possibly ever satisfy. It's impossible. Because the problem isn't in the external projections. It's in the mind. It's in our attitude and mind of our fundamental ground of our own experience. If we can look there in our own experience, in our own consciousness, we could find the ground. If we could get really confident, get really contented, really satisfied in our own fundamental state of ourselves, then we would no longer be so easily had by thinking that all these things that we're looking at and so forth are going to satisfy. But the only solution is we have to go down into the conscious awareness, the source, get really still, really quiet, really confident. And from that place, then all this neediness will disappear, not because we found something to meet our needs, but because the neediness that it started with disappears. We've got to disappear the neediness, not the object of desire to satisfy the need, because it'll never work. Is that...
So you assess your consciousness, and then...
You assess it?
Yeah.
You watch it. You don't do like psychoanalysis or anything. You don't need to analyze anything. It'll
like
come.
How do you get rid of the neediness then?
When it, you have to watch it. This is called mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
You watch it, and you see, wow, I am a needy, sad state of affairs here. So as you watch it, you go, whoa, wow, man, that's a lot of stuff going on. So you go, oh man, I guess I better do something about this. Okay, so then once you decide that, then you better figure out, then you need some tools. So like something like meditate. So why do people meditate? They meditate as a tool to work on this. The meditation is not an end in itself. The meditation is a tool to use to work on the mind. And if you can develop that tool to work on the mind, then slowly but surely, if you can get kind of steady and solid and still in the mind, then you can begin to watch how you're reacting rather than just reacting. You can begin to see the patterns, your Achilles heel. We all have patterns. You start with the most dangerous patterns and work your way back. Don't start with all patterns, because that's not going to happen. But start with the pattern that's leading you the most astray right now. Take your biggest habituation that gets you every time and start with that one. Then slowly work your way back to the, you know, less powerful ones. Is that making sense?
So it seems like you're saying that you don't have needs then. Right?
You don't.
Okay.
That's a Western problem. Starting back from way, way back in the West, sin, original sin, and from then it went downhill. And then we have in the West a big neediness. And then we have things like, I don't want to offend anybody, but we put like a God that's going to take care of it or something like that. We construct all this stuff. And once you construct any kind of dualism outside of your own total, you're completely contented within yourself. You don't need anything beyond your own contentment of yourself. If you're looking for anything outside of that, it won't work. Now, we have a long history of putting it out in various ways. We start from original sin, we put it out in this, we put it out in that, we put it out in society. We have society telling us what to do all the time. Society has all its values it's putting on you. We have society, we have God, we have we have all kinds of stuff.
People.
But it's all stuff. We're completely, the Buddha is really good. We're completely, the Buddha, we all have the Buddha nature inherently within ourselves. We're all completely perfect within ourselves. We have the potential to be totally content and totally complete. Our consciousness is totally complete within self. It doesn't lack anything. Doesn't need anything at all.
So are you saying that we don't need to be in relationships and or anything like that, because, you know, if we just, you know,
centering
ourselves, then...
Right, we don't need to be in relationship in the way you think we need to be in relationship.
Right.
Now, when we really got really still and quiet, we realized, hey, we're on this huge web of relationship. But the whole web of relationship isn't the way that we think it is. Right now it's through our neediness and all this. It's not to say that we're not related, but we're not related in the way we think we are. It's not to say that we all here together aren't all related in consciousness with each other. We're related to consciousness, but we're not related to each other in some neediness of each other. You don't need anything from me. I don't need anything. The only need we have for each other is to give the space and respect of your conscious awareness, your free conscious awareness. I need to respect and give you the space for your own free conscious awareness. The irony of a great relationship is any great relationship, the other person should learn not to need you. They should gain a greater amount of freedom from the relationship than they had before. Is there? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, what I've noticed lately is that when I'm trying to like meditate or just be calm, and if the room and everything is very quiet and still, my brain just kind of like starts. My ear, something's going on there. I don't know.
So everybody that really starts to meditate will realize as soon as you start to meditate, you're not going to immediately get quiet.
Mm-mm.
What's going to happen is all the crap that's in there that you didn't notice before because you were so distracted comes up. Okay, so be really careful here. You have collected a lot of crap. I mean, not all of us, okay?
Yeah.
So we've collected a lot of stuff. All that habitual stuff is roaming around. We go to sit down, your sanity right now is based upon all the distractions that you're in. Watching television, this and that, that. If I take all that away,
right.
you're gonna basically be at the edge of being crazy. Because when I take away that distraction, then the mind left to itself is going, oh my God, all this distraction I've been doing all my life is to avoid my own self. If you look at it, you'll see that every bit of distraction that you're frantically doing is because you're afraid of sitting with yourself. If you weren't afraid of sitting with yourself, you wouldn't need all the distraction. So when you first go to sit with yourself, you got to realize you're going to have to be very patient with a wild person
mm-hmm.
who's like your taming, who was under control only because of distraction. You understand, it was only the distraction was the controlling. You take away the distractions, the habit of distraction, and then the wild person who was down there this whole life trying to avoid yourself with all these distractions has a chance to come up. All your fears, all these fears, all these desires, all this stuff is all able to come up. So does everybody understand, when you first start this process, it will be harder than it was before, because the distractions, like taking drugs, was keeping you under control, but they were just distractions. And in fact, the distractions was avoidance.
Right.
Because somewhere way, way back there, you got scared the heck of yourself, probably at 7. And you're still scared of the dark room by yourself at 7. And you're still running like hell from now with all your distractions. Is everybody? So if we're going to really get in control of this, don't think it's, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying if you want freedom, you're going to have to face the fact that your fears that go way, way back and your needs that go way, way back have to get to the bottom of them, and you can't be moved by them in the way you have been in the past if you want the freedom from those. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck with those forever. They're going to just keep, that's called your karma, will keep continually running the show. And you'll have no space, no freedom. Is that, you see what I'm saying? So.
Yeah, I was wondering why, but you kind of explained this.
Anybody will tell you as soon as they start trying to say.
That's crazy.
You will. That's why you just go back to your meditation, no matter how crazy you get. You just go back to your whatever your topic of meditation is. If it's breathing, if it's whatever your topic of meditation, no matter how crazy you get, you just go back to the topic. No matter what state you have, you just go back to the topic. And everybody in here will go pretty crazy at different times in the process of that. But if you just remember to go back to what you're doing and why that's arising, which makes perfect sense that this stuff will come up. Makes perfect sense. So you have to be very patient with yourself. You have to keep plugging away. Be very patient. First thing you have to do is be very patient with yourself. You have to be extremely patient with yourself and others. If you don't have it, it starts with patience, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, should we do this a little quick?
Yeah, there's a question online.
Well, we're going to pass the question up for a little sutra. So, we're going to read, let's see, what page is that on?
What?
221, right?
Yeah, 220.
Okay. Let's read a little from the Lankavatara Sutra. So we're going to read a Buddhist sutra. It's a little bit on the topic. Let's read. Okay, once again, by means of the Buddha's spiritual power. We're on 221. We're reading the chapter. So
you see this, and you said LXX.
Am I in the?
Yeah, it's the first paragraph.
The first paragraph under this in that paragraph. So proclaim that. Okay, your proclamation of what neither arises nor ceases is not unique. And why not? Because there are other schools whose causes neither arise nor cease. The Bhagavan, the Buddha, teaches that the realms of space, non-alienic cessation, and nirvana neither arise nor cease. Other schools teach that every world arises from causes, while the Buddha teaches that every world arises from conditions of ignorance, desire, karma, and projection. So what does the Buddha say? Every world that arises, everything that arises in your mind, arises from desires or wants. Wants, karma, which is past habits, projections of your minds that we've just been talking about, arise from projections of your mind. Is everybody, are we good so far? But the causes of the one and the conditions of the other are merely different words. The same is true of causing conditions of external objects, for which there is no difference between the explanations of the Buddha and those of other schools. Instead of the nine things that neither arise nor cease, such as elementary particles, first a first cause, a paramount power, a creator, the Buddha also teaches that whatever exists neither arises nor ceases because it exists or non-existence can be determined. Other schools also teach that the four elements are indestructible. Their essential nature neither arises nor ceases, that they are eternal, and that the four elements extend without losing their essential nature. Okay, let's jump ahead, because we don't have a lot of time, to the page 222, and you could see how, you can read this over on your own. The second paragraph is what we want to look at. The Buddha then says, "My teaching are of what neither arises nor ceases." Is not the same thing as teaching as the teaching of what neither arises nor ceasing taught by members of other schools. How so? According to these members of other schools, there is something that exists that has the characteristics of neither arising nor changing. Okay? According to members of other schools, there is something that exists that has the characteristics neither arising nor existing. It does not exist because the second not it does not exist because it appears just as an illusion or a dream does. But how does it not exist? Because form lacks any perceptible characteristics of self-existence. It appears but does not appear. So now this is obviously pretty deep compared to what we've been talking about, but it does not exist because it appears just as an illusion or a dream does. But how does it not exist? Because form lacks any perceptible characteristics of self-existence. So anything that, in terms of form or projection, is something created. It lacks no self-existence in itself. It appears, on one hand, but it actually doesn't appear. It's something constructed. It's something constructed in your experience. It is perceived but not perceived. Therefore, whatever exists neither exists nor does not exist. Once you realize it is nothing but the perception of your own mind, its projections do not arise, you dwell in peace and happiness, and worldly concerns cease. That's a little bit deep, but if you understand how the mind actually, at some point in your meditation, if you actually were begin to practice meditation and practice mindfulness, you'd eventually actually see yourself, how you're constructing, how the world that you're existing in and the thoughts and emotions that are arising in your minds are things that you're constructing. They're not actually there, like in the sense that they exist outside of your mind. They appear to, but they in fact arise from the mind. And if you were able to look at this very carefully, once you realize it is nothing but the perception of your own mind, your own consciousness, and that its projections do not arise. At that point, when you realize that everything is a projection of your mind, then you dwell in a kind of peace and happiness where worldly concerns cease. Now, that's a high bar. That's a high bar of... this is a... Our theme for tonight is fun. That's a high bar of fun. That may be beyond fun. But this is the peace and happiness that we're talking about. The last paragraph on 223, and then we're going to stop. Therefore, Mama, seeing that what has no form is better than not seeing what has form. Seeing what has form is the cause of rebirth. So birth and death, even birth and death itself, and even... is that the consciousness, even, this is something that from the Western scientific view is very hard for us to understand, but from the view of this free conscious awareness we're talking about, even your body, that being in your body is an attachment of consciousness. Even thinking that you exist primarily in the body is a kind of form of being, of your consciousness being attached to a certain kind of form. Hence is better where form projections do not arise. What neither arises nor ceasing, I call nirvana. So one of the things we're talking about is goals and meanings and purposes. So from the Buddhist way, what neither arises, doesn't arise, nor ceases, is what I call nirvana. Buddha, nirvana is to see meaning of what is true, what is truly so. What's nirvana? To see what really is. To see how things really is in nirvana, not through the habituation of your karma, which is a limitation of how things through that your perspective. So nirvana is to see things as they really are. And to get free of the net of thoughts of previous projections. To see things as they really are in the present moment, not through the projections of the past taking up the present experience. To attain the personal realization of the noble knowledge of the Buddha is what I call nirvana. Okay, so there's a little text, but it's probably time to stop so that people can go on about their